Or, here, you should do it. You take it. No? All right.
You know how to introduce RepCom.
All right.
And forward.
This with treadmills on it.
Team?
Ready.
Team, we're going to start. In the absence of our fearless leader, one of us is stepping up.
Adam Bud.
Wow.
We're right behind you.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah, we're following you,
so,
right?
So, welcome, yeah. Everyone.
Yeah.
This is the House Committee on Higher Education meeting, Wednesday, March 20th, and I am calling to order this meeting. And we are going to get started before Chair Dembro arrives. He's held up in this weather a little bit. The order that we will proceed in this morning is, first of all, a public hearing on House Bill 2958, followed up by 3296, and that's enough for right now. We'll then get down into other things. But let's begin by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2958 and call up Rep. Comp. Well, Victoria, would you get us started? Briefly introduce the bill.
Happy to. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2958 requires community colleges to distribute specified information to public school students in grades 11 and 12 annually, requires representatives of State Board of Education and Higher Education Coordinating Commission to meet regularly for the purpose of improving coordination between public secondary schools and community colleges, declares an emergency, is effective July 1, 2013.
Do it. We're ready. Rep. Comp, take it away whenever you are.
Okay. Well, good morning, Vice Chair Huffman, Vice Chair Harker, and to the committee. I'm looking at the makeup of your committee, and it's like, I'm sure glad Victoria is there representing the feminine perspective. So
Rep. Comp, the last time this dais was insulted, it did not go well for the testifier.
We were
called old. What
old
were we
white
called?
Men.
Old white. Men. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well. And anyway.
We didn't
remember,
make
it was a female either. Speaker that made this happen.
Yeah.
And right. We do the best with what we've got.
Okay, I guess I better stick to my testimony. My name is Betty Comp, and I represent House District 22. That's Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and North Salem. Victoria gave a very accurate of what this short, concise bill does. The goal here is to start making that bridge from high schools to apprenticeships to community colleges to the university. Yesterday in our education subcommittee in Ways and Means, we heard a tremendous report about the Aspire program and how we have mentors in our high school seeking this information. What it would do is give high school students increased information about what different programs different universities have, again, the apprenticeships, or what they might be looking for, an associate's degree. The example I would choose is one of nursing. And that's because I have a daughter that's now an RN, but she went to several different community colleges and hopped around for a few years. And really, for her to finish her degree, it was really critical that she know which school systems had which courses, because she was working and a mom and all these things. And so students really recognized, especially in our state, we have so many students. Listen to these couple numbers. We had 344,000 students apply for scholarships, grants, and financial aid here in January. 344,000. In less than 24 hours, the people that got all those scholarships, grants, and aids knew, because that's how long it took to get the top ones. We serve 75,000 students with some sort of private, public scholarships and grants. And again, it's a part of our system. If they miss some of those deadlines, they really have to wait until fall or the next semester to be able to even begin to think that they might get some financial aid or get the structure in place so that they can complete college or an know, your programs within 2 years. So what I would ask is your support for this bill. It really, what it does, it sets up a coordinating commission at the state board to meet regularly on the purposes of communicating degree information, and it just advised to those juniors and seniors. I wish this was happening for one of my grandsons, because he took 3 AP classes. He's a senior this year. He decided he didn't want to, you know, spend his money on taking the test. So I said, well, what are you going to do for the next couple months? He says, Grandma, I'm just going to play around. We have this real open relationship, as you can tell. And it's like, okay, I wasn't going to lecture him, but it's like, you are just wasting an education opportunity, and it shouldn't be happening. But I wasn't going to fuss at him. So I'm open to any questions and just ask for your support. Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Grandma. Representative Cobb.
Oh. Oh, no, that's cool.
I think you can refer to him as Grandpa.
I think that's so, true. But I only have 8 grandchildren I have to take, that I need to watch out for. Their parents take care of them.
Thank you very much for this. Colleagues, any questions of the representative?
I assume.
Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for being here today. A few questions. The bill calls for distributing, this information you're referring to, i.e. post-secondary opportunities, and it does just spell out community colleges, right? You're not talking about the whole OUS system here. I just see community colleges in the bill.
Oh, that's a good question.
But,
it does just say community colleges. You're right.
Okay. Are you envisioning this information being distributed directly to the students on a personal basis through the schools? Are the K-12 system, is the K-12 system the intermediaries for this information or the pass-through? Is that what you have in mind?
Right. Chair Denbrough, Representative Johnson, what I see is that this is a component of part of the governor's initiatives for the 40-40-20. And this would go to high schools, but also there's another component, and that is to have more counselors, more people engaged in the Aspire program, so that once schools get this information, there is a method to distributing it to students directly.
And you're not calling for additional investment in Aspire. You're just hoping that this will happen because it's encouraged to happen.
Actually, this bill does not ask for any additional funds, but the bill that we heard in the education sub yesterday, there is, I can't remember the figure off the top of my head, but there are additional funds that we're hoping to double the amount of schools that have Aspire tutors and support.
Okay. One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
You're calling then for some regular meetings between the State Board and the HEC, if you will.
Right.
For the purpose of, talking about the issue. I would encourage us, sir, to think about going beyond that, and I know that there is a bill in the legislature that would actually begin to require some degree of dual accreditation, meaning when a student comes out of high school, you don't just come out with a diploma, but you come out with something else that gives you a jump start into the next level, whatever that is. My perspective would be, I think these guys are doing a lot of talking. It's time for a little more action, perhaps. So maybe we can work together on that, but I'd be sure interested in seeing some of that happen as a friendly legislative shove, if you will, to make sure that that happens at that level.
Yeah, I would love to do that. And Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the other thing, we have somebody that is, Mr. Bennett's going to testify on behalf of like skill centers, like the Saban Skill Centers. Again, this is a proven program that is working very cohesively with several community colleges, and so that students clearly know in their different programs how many credits they're earning, what the internships are looking like, because they are literally half day in the classroom, half day out on work sites, and that the other part of that is that they know this when they go in, and there are 5 school districts, 5 high schools that feed into the Saban Skills Center. So this is not just for one school district. This is for multiple clusters of high schools to be taking this opportunity. And we do have another bill that will be coming to us through policy in the House Education about creating more of these regional schools for you know, skills to get apprenticeship, I mean, for AA degrees. So, yes, there has to be communication between these two groups of people. Otherwise, this will fall apart.
Okay, thank you.
Big lofty goals.
Shall I call up Mr. Bennett first, or do you have a question for Rep. Comp?
I have a facetious sort of a question for Rep. Comp, if that's okay.
No. So.
Well, I already asked.
No, it's serious. It's serious. I just want to get something on the record. I know she can't do anything. Well, she could. She has a gavel. May I proceed, Mr. Chair?
I will indulge you.
Rep. Comp, would you be willing to attach an ask to this also, because we do ask a lot out of our community colleges, and I support this completely, and I know the community colleges do also, and some of them, as you point out, are doing it already. I think to be most effective, this goes back to what we've been talking about quite a bit on this committee about advising.
Mm-hmm.
And having a stronger advising component at all levels of higher ed. And so would you be willing to stipulate that as long as we can get the $510 million ask for community colleges rather than the recommended $428 million, that we could move forward with this? Because I think more money for community colleges would not only be necessary for this, but necessary in general.
Okay. Chair Denbrough and Representative Huffman, and I'm being very candid, this is not facetious. If you would like for us as sub-chairs to request a budget note, that as we are really working hard to increase the amount of funds for the community colleges above 428, that if we could put this along with the policy bill, either a bill like this or with our regular community college bill, to so stipulate that X amount of funds is put into counseling and support for programs like this.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. And I did want to get that on the record, because there have been a lot of conversations going on in the hallway and in offices, but I hadn't had the opportunity to specifically say publicly that I think we need to step up, and I appreciate the subcommittee's hope to get more money for community colleges.
Well, thank you. And just one more comment to kind of update you where we're at with the education sub-budget. This week, Senator Monroe and I are meeting individually with our sub-chairs to committee members to get their priorities from them. We are working hand in hand with ODE, the governor's office, on looking at what that priority list looks like. Please don't hesitate to communicate with, in the House side, is Representative Springer and Representative Frederick, about any thoughts that you have if you'd like to have certain amounts prioritized.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for that.
And I need to go to committee.
Yes, but before you run off, Rep. Comp, let me also say that I'd be remiss if I didn't communicate from this committee that we would also like to see an increase in the opportunity grant funding and the university funding as well.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough. Again, another update. The report that we received yesterday from OSAC is going to, and we talked with the big co-chairs yesterday afternoon about this issue, and we are looking at a potential 8% increase in the funding for OSAC.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
And any other figure you want out of the top of my head, just go ahead and ask. But thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you,
Rep. Comp. Okay, I'm going to call up Chuck Bennett. If you'd come up, please, Chuck. And let me also say, while Chuck is settling himself, I got a message from the Community College Association. They had hoped to be here today, but Andrea Henderson I don't know if it's an illness or something's keeping her from being here. And John Wyckoff was caught up in the same traffic that delayed me. So, Chuck.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I'm also representing someone who was unable to get here this morning, so I was notified, and will just highlight his testimony. Joe Crum from North Clackamas School District was scheduled to be here, and we've submitted his testimony in writing. Mr. Chairman, COSA, as well as, I think you'll see obviously from the North Clackamas School District, support Rep. Comp's bill. We believe that students benefit tremendously from the relationships developed during their high school career with community colleges. We're highlighting North Clackamas. It has one of the really exemplary programs around the state, particularly under the leadership of Karen Phillips, who is the principal of the Saban Schellenberg Professional Technical Center at North Clackamas School Districts. They have relationships with three community colleges in their general vicinity. It's been a very rich program. The testimony highlights these. I want to point to a few of them. They have developed dozens of courses in relationship with these community colleges that bring credit to students on the high school campus. They have annual events featuring community college representatives for English language learners as well as other students that not only give them a chance to understand what the college environment looks like, but also to participate and sign up for a variety of courses. This has been copied around the state. We have a number of these kinds of programs that are underway at high school campuses. This is really the tremendous direction in K-12 education in cooperation with community colleges as well as campuses in the OUS system. There are, these are not, and I want to really underscore, these are not just opportunities for high school students to learn about what college is and whether or not they want to go to college. It's really opportunities for many of them to leave with substantial number of college credits, which saves their parents, families, and presumably other parts of the system a tremendous amount of money as they accumulate these credits leaving high school. We believe this bill will help other districts or encourage other districts to develop similar programs where they don't exist. I do want to underscore that they do exist substantially around the state. The only if there is any caveat in Mr. Crum's testimony, is to make sure that this bill doesn't in any way interfere with existing programs, that it supports existing programs. With that, I'll try to answer any questions you might have on it. I do feel real comfortable with this committee. It's clearly a dais that I would understand, aside from Victoria.
Yes, not my day.
We're happy to have you, Chuck. Any questions, Mr. Bennett? Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck, you referenced North Clackamas and what they're doing, and some of us come from districts where there's already a very, very robust yes. Aspire program. So just to clarify, I think you touched on at the end that what you see or what COSA sees here is extending this to the other 190-some-odd districts out there. I don't know how many don't currently have a good program, but the point is it goes beyond so that it happens everywhere instead of just in those districts that can and have been able to up to this point. And obviously the rub will be in some districts is, okay, where's the staffing going to come from? Where's
right.
the support going to come from? And this doesn't come with any sort of means to help that situation. So
they just as you know, Representative Johnson, one of the roles of ESDs, along with other activities they do, is to assist campus or high schools where these programs would like to be developed and don't have the either the personnel or facility to accomplish it. I think a prime example is the Eastern Promise and how that has been developed through Intermountain ESD. We're seeing, generally, these programs, where they can be accomplished reasonably easily geographically, are being developed very rapidly as high schools, as K-12 continues its program of accomplishing the 40-40-20 goal. And often the problems arise due to just simply geography. I mean, right, whether or not you've got one of the community colleges close enough to really involve yourself, and that's mm-hmm. where we're working on distance learning and using that kind of. I think this is one of those things that with this kind of encouragement, this kind of clear statement of state policy, we'll see K-12 as well as community colleges using whatever facility, including the ESDs, to accomplish this goal.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you, Chuck.
Thank you very much.
Perspective. Okay, colleagues, I'll let you know what the next steps are for this bill. And I'll close this public hearing on House Bill 2958. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3296. Call up two esteemed representatives.
What about, wasn't it?
Wow. The two gray-headed guys.
Barnhart, do you want to start?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11, and it's a great, great pleasure to be in front of this committee this morning. Mm-hmm. This bill came to my attention 2 years ago when the Rules Committee was presented with it with an earlier draft of the bill, and the issue that that faces educational institutions and students constantly these days, so I am told, is the issue of maintaining eligibility for amateur status so that they can participate in middle school, high school, and university athletic programs rather than inadvertently or by the intent of other people losing their eligibility as a result of the violation of rules that are promulgated by the General Athletic Amateur Associations. Oregon has had a law for some time on this whole issue involving agents and agency. But the law is now obsolete and has been for a while. We have seen nationally some rather high-profile cases of star athletes who have lost their eligibility because of the actions of agents and runners and others who have interfered, in effect, with the relationship between the school and the athlete, the athlete and the athlete's own eligibility requirements. House Bill 3296 is the next step in the movement of that bill. I should tell you that the bill that last time passed the Rules Committee, passed the House unanimously, died in the Senate because of some specific problems with the way with the bill and the way it was put together. This bill, we think, has finally threaded the needle, especially if you look at the Dash 2 amendment to the bill. What attracted my attention to the bill in the first place had to do with the notice requirements in the original bill, which were not sufficient, and they're not sufficient in the original draft of House Bill 3296. We made the fixes that are necessary in that bill so that the notices that are required to be made to the educational institutions when people want to have conversations with athletes about professional involvement to take place, those notices are in here. Another aspect that I think is really very important for us to consider are the fact that the enforcement of this is through the unfair trade practices law, and that's also contained in the bill. Colleagues, members of the committee, the point of this bill, of course, is to protect our amateur athletes so that they can get the education that they are working toward. they can keep their scholarships if they have them. They can play sports at the level at which they're engaged if they want to do that. Nothing in this bill prevents an athlete who wants to turn pro from doing it. It simply protects those athletes who would do it by inadvertence as a result mostly of the actions of other people.
Thank you very much, Rep. Barnhart. Rep. Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and all your colleagues and committee members. I'm Gene Wisnant, State Representative, House District 53. We want to get a photograph of this with Phil and I carrying a bill together. This is a tax bill?
No. But he would be open to that, Rep. Wisnant.
If you can figure out a way to do it.
As a very serious college sports fan, I'm really honored that Representative Barnhart asked me to co-sponsor this bill with him because it is an important piece of legislation. Too many of our young athletes, and even elementary school, middle school, high school, and college have had their lives, their educational opportunities, and even a few of them even potential professional careers destroyed by action of people who may have not had all the total interest of the young athlete in mind. The bill clarifies the definition of an agent contract and an athlete agent, and I even support the Fair Trades Act part of this amendment. So, Mr. Hawkins is going to describe in detail some really bad examples to justify this bill, and again, thank you for hearing the bill. I hope you'll move the bill soon with the amendment to help protect our young athletes. Thank you.
Thank you, both of you. Colleagues, yes, Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wisnant, I would just suggest that as the relationship that the Chair and I have, the next time we co-carry a bill on the House floor, I'm going to go first as the co-carrier, and I would just recommend the same for you because I don't think you would have much left to say after Representative Barnhart gets finished. So I look forward to this on the floor.
You guys get a little closer there.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you. Any other questions, colleagues? Okay, thank you very much, both of you, representatives. Okay, I'm going to call up Phil Donovan and Jeff Hawkins, please. Hawk, welcome.
Thank you. Where he's from. Which school is Jeff from?
It's not OSU.
It's hard to tell.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Dembrough and distinguished committee members. My name is Jeff Hawkins, for the record, and I'm the Director of Football Operations at the University of Oregon. I'm here today because I wanted to talk about this, athlete agents, sports agents, that are terms that are all synonymous, so you don't have to get confused when if I jump around between them, or even the word agent. But since the 1960s, since salaries and endorsements started to skyrocket, we've seen a tremendous growth of the number of agents out there. And the agents have powerful economic incentives to build relationships with high schools and college athletes. And unfortunately, they use those incentives like cash, cars, bling, trips, that puts their students' education in danger as well as their athletic career. In response, elected officials have enacted laws on the national level. It was SPARTA. On the state level, it was the UAAA, the Uniform Athlete Agent Act. The intention of these laws was to protect student athletes, create oversight of the athlete agent industry, and to police the sometimes shadowy interactions between them. The other goals were to standardize the registration procedures and record-keeping policies and practical monitoring disciplinary systems. In theory, they were to create a level playing field for everybody, including the agents. But the very essence of this problem has been the definition of what an agent is, or the athlete agent, like I said, to go back and forth. The contract advisor is typically deemed the agent, and he negotiates the big contract. But he's supported by a number of people. They could be, they call themselves mentors. They're financial advisors, tax advisors, trainers. It goes across the whole gamut. And they're not regulated professions. They're often called runners as a category. The runner is a paid service that offers to form relationships between student-athletes and the agent himself. And when it comes time to negotiate those big contracts, the problem is these agents, these runners call themselves everything but what they are. They're agents. That's all they are. And they do this to avoid the regulations to protect the student athletes. And we mentioned before, it's not just the college athletes that are being victimized. It's also the high school athletes as well. And they, what they plan on doing, they target on these young men and women, and in order to, in some cases, trying to negotiate on their behalf to get to a university even for the highest bidder. This is a big issue because they cast such a broad net. And to give you an idea, our players at Oregon, we did a straw poll one time with them, and out of our players in the room, 82% of them thought they were going to go to the Professional Football League. And really, and quite honestly, it's about 2.5% that go. When we played in the national championship, we had one player drafted. But yet they all have that dream that they want to go and play on Sunday, whereas maybe 30% actually play on Saturday. Recently, the NCAA sought to provide clarity by expanding the definition of an agent. And essentially, it comes down to anybody who seeks to represent or to gain profit. House Bill 3296 does a few things. First, it makes Oregon's statute consistent with the NCAA definition. By doing that, we ensure that anyone's looking to make a buck off a student athlete has to contact the institution first. The Dash 2 amendment provides clear direction about who the agent has to contact at the educational institution. This creates a level of transparency that is good for everybody and keeps agents from blurring the lines. It also creates meaningful enforcement of the law. Currently, enforcement is left to local district attorneys who are without the resources or time to pursue these cases. Although the UAAA has been on the books for well over a decade, and probably 42 states have them, no one has effectively enforced this law in its present form, and it's been pretty inconsistent. North Carolina recently, a very high-profile case that came about 3 years ago, what happened was that an agent and a third party were funneling cash and trips and bling to North Carolina players, and about a dozen of them were declared ineligible. This case devastated the Tar Heels football program that year and implicated, as I mentioned, a dozen players, that, and including a football coach as well. It remains to see if they'll ever be convicted, but at least the Secretary of State has gone forth and put charges out. Locally, here at the University of Oregon, 5 years ago, we had a player that got a $100 handshake. And he was guilt-ridden, and he approached me a month later, just before the season started, and admitted what he had done. And he said to the whole team, and he did more for education than anybody ever could. But provided, after it was released in the newspaper, a splash was made, the story just went away, and no one went after the agent or the runner. The runner changed his name, moved to Florida, and now it's the same thing on the high school level. Never before have we had this chance to create positive change than we have right now. We have an opportunity to fix because we know what's wrong. And this House bill is the first step towards that.
Thank you very much, Paul. Yes, Russ Greenwood.
Does this relate to recruiting services as well, like that Texas business that's got you guys into some?
It would relate right across the board. Right across the board.
That person would have been an agent under this definition?
Correct. And that's a term, another term that's synonymous, street agent. You can't operate underneath the radar. It doesn't prevent people from doing their job. It just makes sure we know who you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you, Rep. Greenlee. Regarding the private right of action, the UTPA provision, is there possible action against the employer of the agent? I mean, you indicated, Hawk, that some of these agents are, in effect, acting as the proxies for real agents. And so are the real agents that have a relationship with these runner agents, are they vulnerable under this?
They are, because in the wording of the NCAA definition, it directly or indirectly, and if we use this definition, then I would assume it would fall under the law. So, yes, it does.
Okay. I'm pleased with that. Thank you. Other questions, colleagues? Yes, Rick Johnson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. This wouldn't impact runners or those type of folks outside of Oregon, though, correct? Who would be interacting with student athletes at various levels who the university may be trying to recruit, but on the other hand, you've got a runner that could be doing his or her work here to try to bring that athlete to the university's attention, right? But they wouldn't be covered by this?
If they interact with our student athletes that are presently here in the University of Oregon,
okay,
it would affect them, and it would protect our high school athletes as well. I can't say that Oregon's law would protect an athlete in California.
Right.
But what we're trying to do, and I work on a national stage, I'm chairman of the DFOs across the country, what I'm hoping to is to use what we do here to pass on to the rest of the country.
Okay. And could you define DFO?
DFO is the Director of Football Operation, and essentially every university has one. And basically we do the things that no one else wants to do.
Thank you. We obviously do it well. Any other questions, colleagues? Okay, thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Colleagues will, I'm sure, be scheduling work sessions sometime soon on this bill. With that, I'm going to close this.
Are there speakers here?
No. I'm going to close this public hearing on House Bill 3296. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2986. Actually, this is mine, so I'm going to go down.
Victoria, would you like to introduce this bill before Chair Dembo starts speaking to us again?
I'd be happy to. Thank you. Members of the committee, House Bill 2986 directs the Department of Transportation and Department of Corrections to work with the Judicial Department to assist individuals in obtaining driver's licenses under specified circumstances upon release from incarceration.
Thank you, colleagues. Chair Harker. Vice Chair Huffman, colleagues, Michael Dembro, State Representative for House District 45, Northeast Portland to Park Rose. And I'm bringing before you, this is one of those proverbial little bills that I'm hoping will solve a problem that affects not a lot of people, but affects those people quite profoundly, I believe. If you look at the amendments that are in front of you on the dais, this is a gut and stuff of the original bill as trying to get this right, and it includes a number of whereases. It opens with whereases, which I think really lays out the problem that this bill is trying to solve, and I'll just walk you through them. And if you go through these whereases, you'll see that there are a number of people who are caught in one of those proverbial vicious cycles that we're trying to break them free of. It has to do with the problem that someone who has been incarcerated for offenses, which very often include a traffic violation for which they owe fines. Upon their release, they may have had a driver's license before. They may well have had a driver's license. They should have had a driver's license, but they lost that license as a result of the offense, and they can't have their license restored until they've paid off their fines. Now, many ex-offenders have challenges finding employment, and many of them need to have their skills upgraded in order to find employment. And we have a number of pre-apprenticeship and apprenticeship programs here in this state that are really good avenues for ex-offenders to find a way to reintegrate into society. But for many, if not all, of these apprenticeship programs, a student has to have a driver's license, a valid driver's license, so that they can get to the job site where they're placed. They don't have a driver's license because their driver's license has been suspended. They can't get their driver's license back because they have no money to do so. So they can't be students in these programs. Whereas on the other hand, if they could be students in the programs and be successful in those programs, they could then get employment, which would get them income, which would allow them to pay off their fines and move on with their lives. So what this bill seeks to do is it tells the court that the court can rescind the suspension essentially on a provisional basis to allow the student to enter a pre-apprenticeship program to be successful in that program. And as long as they're successful in that program and then begin to repay their fines, they can have their suspension rescinded and, in effect, have their license. So, you know, I've been working with legislative counsel and with advice from people from Department of Transportation and Corrections, trying to get this right. I hope that we do have it right, and that's what this bill seeks to do.
Vice Chair Huffman appears to have a question or a comment here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, is somebody going to testify? It's my understanding that there's been a fairly robust pilot program connected with the reentry program that Marion County has. Have you talked to, like, Commissioner Carlson or anybody connected with that program, or will Amy or somebody be able to testify and let us know how this bill relates to that, and is it an expansion of the pilot program? Mm-hmm. Is there any connection at all?
I'm actually not really familiar with the pilot program, so I hope that she will speak to it.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And Representative Gorsuch also.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. This sounds similar to a program that I've heard of before, and I don't know if we have it in Oregon or not, but people who have suspended licenses but do get permission, for instance, to go to and from work. It sounds like a similar sort of thing, only it's focused on ex-offenders. Is that correct?
That sounds similar in principle. Yeah.
And it certainly makes sense. I mean, the idea is to, I think probably where we fall down the most, and see if you agree with this, but I think where we fall down the most is in reintegrating offenders back into society. So this would help with that process.
I believe that it would, Rip Gorsuch. And in addition, you know, I think that this would also help us with our 40-40-20 goal, right? And I mean that in all seriousness. You know, that middle 40, you know, getting people through apprenticeship programs or community college programs, so important. And you know, we're already starting to see a big difference in success with that middle 40 is with the population that I would call our low-hanging fruit. But the population that we're talking about here are more our high-hanging fruit. But we're going to have to get to them as well if we're really going to, you know, get to the skills level that all Oregonians are going to need. So that's a part of what I'm seeking in this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair.
Is ODOT and DOC both lined up to testify, or who do we have?
I have Amy Joyce from ODOT and James Bowles from PCC signed up here. And I don't know about others that might want to speak. Are there others here who would like to speak?
Can I?
Apparently.
ask a question then.
Oh, sure, sure.
Yeah.
Of course.
Representative, what about Department of Corrections? Have you worked with them to clarify what their role would be, and is there some preparatory things that could be done while they're still incarcerated before release?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, Department of Corrections already works with offenders while they're incarcerated on the process of getting their licenses back, because all of them, while this was explained to me, all of them you know, lose their licenses while they're incarcerated. Their licenses are physically removed from them, and then work with them on the process of getting them back. But for those who have these outstanding fines, that's not possible, and you know, that's an impediment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Representative, on page 3, I guess it's sub 5 of the dash. I guess these are dash 1s or dash 2s, but you talk about how if the individual can apply for reinstatement by virtue of participation in a program, an apprenticeship program, but then the language says the court shall grant the motion if the court determines a person is in fact enrolled. But I just wonder, you know, in terms of mandating behavior by the court or recognizing there could be other extenuating circumstances that they might be uncomfortable with, but I just wondered if corrections or anyone has had any feedback on that language.
I haven't heard any yet. And colleagues, we just got these amendments yesterday and sent them out at the end of the day. So obviously we can't work this bill today. And you know, I would want to get comments from all the affected agencies before we do that.
Thank you.
And we do have Cindy Booth from Corrections here also, who will testify and address some of these questions. Thanks a lot for bringing the bill forth. It sounds like it addresses a clear need, an important one, and we need to get a little bit of clarity as to how it might interact with some existing programs and make it work efficiently. So while I still have the gavel, I would like to call up Amy Joyce, James Bowles, and Cindy Booth. I think we can fit all three there at once.
We move the site 10 minutes. Good.
That's true.
And decide amongst you who's going first. Oh, sorry.
Yes. Actually, James, maybe you should go first just to talk about the need, you know, that this is addressing.
Good morning. I'm James Bowles. I'm the director of the Margaret Carter Skills Center for Portland Community College. The Skills Center has been, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2986. The Skills Center has been in existence for almost 24 years, and we have provided education and training for a population that needs to re-enter the workforce. We have worked with a lot of ex-offenders and populations that have a need to upgrade their skills and enter training programs to get back into the workforce. Many of them go on to college, but today we're here to talk about the population that re-enters the workforce. They face barriers of training. They face barriers of trust with employers, and one of the last barriers that they face after they get a job is their driving privileges. Most of your CTE programs are involved in the roads, building, bridges, construction, and that work type of work, and it requires that they have access to transportation, oftentimes before public transportation starts in the morning. Like TriMet, for example, the bus service starts at 5:30. The light rail starts at 5:30. Oftentimes, this population is required to be at the work site at 6 or 6:15, which is not possible. And without driving privileges, they would not be able to get there.
Okay. Thank you, James. Cindy, Amy.
Good morning, Chair Dembrow and members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Talking about the Dash 1 amendment, which Chair Dembrow described as a gut and stuff. So what I can say is the DMV is still analyzing this amendment to determine whether there are any maybe language changes that need to happen or that sort of thing. Sort of, you know, what exists today, Department of Corrections and ODOT have a cooperative agreement by which we do a couple of things to assist offenders who are transitioning out of incarceration in terms of reacquiring the driver license or even an ID card. And those two current systems are actually transporting inmates to a DMV and off hours to process documents. And DOC will have done the legwork ahead of time in helping to get the documentation necessary to be able to get to a driver license. And then DOC and ODOT have recently completed an agreement by which we can assist in processing what's called a valid with previous photo, so there isn't the need to transport the inmate to a DMV in off hours, but the transaction can be done to assist those folks before they are released in reacquiring that driver license or get an ID card. So this bill then with the Dash 1 amendment would have to do just with the type of suspension having to do with the person who hasn't paid all their traffic fines with the court. So just one of the concerns about the language that that we would want to work on is the direction to the court that they shall direct ODOT to reinstate. Now, of course, folks can be suspended for a myriad of reasons, only one of which is non-payment of fines. So we'd want to clarify that if maybe just lifting that suspension for the non-payment of fines, maybe not some of the other suspensions, unless that's the desire of the committee. And just some other language issues that we'd want to work on with the chair to get that language where it would need to be so that DMV could work the details to make this happen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Dimbrough. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cindy Booth. I'm the Transition and Reentry Administrator for the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to provide some information with regard to the Dash 1 amendments. Again, we did receive them last evening, and we are still going through them, but upon first reading, it would appear that this actually will broaden the category of individuals who could apply for reinstatement of their driver's license privileges beyond those that are releasing from prison. But I also would like to respond to Representative Huffman's earlier question about how this work impacts what is already in place. As Amy outlined, the agreements between the Oregon Department of Corrections and the DMV. We do have intergovernmental agreements based on legislation passed in 2009, and it's codified in statute 802, I believe. Yeah, the licensing, driver's license rules, or statutes rather. And we have quite a robust working relationship with DMV where, as Amy outlined, we do monthly DMV trips from two of our institutions to serve up to 10 inmates from each location. And they're eligible to apply for an identification card. Getting to that point also requires that the person have a birth certificate and Social Security card or other identification documents required. So the Governor's Reentry Council back in 2007 began in earnest to encourage the Department of Corrections to initiate processes that would ensure that we have those documents on file on behalf of the offender. So through that work, we are at a better place to be able to move forward with other opportunities, such as Amy outlined the valid with previous photo. So those inmates who have an Oregon driver's license on record, whether it is suspended or revoked or just needs to be renewed, we can assist them close to their release from prison to actually obtain their driver's license. I would envision that this legislation might be helpful in that way also, but we would like to review the legislation in more detail to be able to answer those specific questions.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cindy. Colleagues, any questions of the panelists? Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. We look forward to your recommendations. With that, I'll close this public hearing on House Bill 2986. And I am going to open an informational hearing on
exactly are we calling it? Minority coaching recruitment. Okay. And I'll call up Ryan Hageman and Lorraine Davis, please. Okay, just as some background to this, you all probably remember there was some public conversation around the process that was used to replace the outgoing head coach at the University of Oregon back in January, I guess, and questions were raised about the bill that we passed back in the 2009 session and whether or not the University of Oregon had been in compliance with that legislation. And at that time, I felt that it would be appropriate for us to seek of the Oregon University system a status report, an update on how all the universities have been complying with that requirement that we passed back in 2009. And so Oregon University System did prepare that report. You've all received it. And Ryan is going to walk us through it, I assume, and we'll have some witnesses to talk about it, including some people who've been working on this on the ground.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
yes, Representative,
very brief comment.
Certainly.
I really appreciate this hearing, and I ask you for it. The reason I did is because when we were working on the bill that became ORS 352382B, the question was, would there need to be an enforcement mechanism to this statute? And I argued very strongly that we didn't need an enforcement statute. I mean, an enforcement part of it, that universities tend to follow laws, and the main way to enforce it would be to have the kind of hearing we're having today. So I want to make sure that I didn't ask this because I wanted to pick on U of O or OSU or anybody else. I just wanted to bring light to see how it was going and to hear about successes in this, and my understanding is there have been a lot of successes as a result of this. So I just wanted to put that on the record is where I was coming from.
Thank you, Rep. Greenlee. Ryan, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ryan Hageman, and I am the general counsel for the Oregon University System. Thank you for the opportunity to take a few moments to speak about Oregon Revised Statute 352-382-B for the recruitment of athletic directors and head coaches at Oregon's four-year public universities. Previously, we compiled statistical information about these searches from 2011 and circulated the memorandum to Chair Dimbrough. I believe it's been distributed to each of you for your information, and as Chair Dimbrough mentioned, I'd be happy to talk about any of those specifics today. It provides the data on the 18 searches across the system since 2011 that are implicated by the requirements of ORS 352-382-B. Importantly, the memorandum also includes a description of the various strategies and methodologies that OUS institutions employ to ensure a deep, diverse applicant pool for these high-profile positions. This is critical for several reasons, including but not limited to our ability to comply with the policy directive of ORS 352-382-B. A robust, diverse applicant pool for all open positions, including the athletic directors and head coaches described in that statute, is important because under federal law, we are unable to require an applicant to identify racial background or any other indication of minority status. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 states that it is unlawful for an employer to limit, segregate, or classify employees or applicants for employees in any way which would deprive or tend to deprive an individual of employment opportunities or otherwise adversely affect his status as an employee because of such individual's race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Without these active recruitment efforts to develop a deep, diverse applicant pool, therefore, including mechanisms that would encourage applicants themselves to self-report their racial identity on affirmative action compliance forms, our ability to meet the policy objectives of ORS 352-382B and our desire for a diverse workforce generally becomes more challenging. All of our institutions consistently strive to reevaluate human resource processes to enhance outreach, to develop those diverse applicant pools, and to improve the collection of data. This is why we felt it important to include all of the information on those recruitment and HR processes to Chair Dembro in our report. They represent a critical element in the success of our recruitment efforts and compliance with federal and state law, including ORS 352-382B. I would be happy to take questions now or wait for Dr. Lorraine Davis from the University of Oregon.
Thank you, Ryan. Why don't we hear from Director Davis, please?
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Chair Dembro and members of the House Higher Ed Committee, for the record, my name is Lorraine Davis. I've been in various administrative positions at the university and am currently Special Assistant to the President, Provost, and Athletic Director. I was Interim Athletic Director when what I knew as House Bill 3118 was passed, and more recently as Special Assistant, I've been involved in the searches since the passage of House Bill 3118. The University of Oregon supports the recruitment of minority candidates in Oregon's diversity law that requires public institutions of higher education to consider a minority candidate for vacant coaching and athletic director positions. We are committed to minority coaching, interviewing, and hiring. We follow not only what I think is the letter of the law, but also the spirit of the law. We believe that the spirit of the law means that we reach out specifically to be sure that our applicant pools are rich and deep and have and include members of a diverse population. We're also open-minded to persons outside of our current staffs, particularly if they are minorities, even when we have strong internal candidates. Since the passage of House Bill 3118, the University of Oregon has hired 3 head coaches and an athletic director. We most recently hired an African American to lead the U of O track and field team. The U of O has followed the law by interviewing a minority candidate when we searched for a new U of O women's soccer coach. And we also interviewed 2 minority candidates while searching for the new men's U of O football coach. I was involved in the hiring of our current athletic director under House Bill 3118. It was just in the process of passing, and I can say we interviewed a minority candidate in that process. We took that responsibility seriously because a more diverse administration and coaching staff is positive for our institution and our state. A head coaching hire I was involved with prior to 3118 also included interviews with 2 minority candidates. At the University of Oregon, we desire to hire head coaches and athletic directors who develop our student athletes from an athletic perspective, an academic perspective, and a perspective of social responsibility. Minority candidates are fully considered, interviewed, and when the best candidate emerges, is hired. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Davis. Questions? Rep. Johnson.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the panel. I think they did a wonderful job, and I think they just validated what those of us who closely follow college athletics in Oregon have believed for quite some time, that we have incredibly diverse and talented coaching staffs at all of our universities that do a wonderful job of coaching our student athletes. So I appreciate what you're doing and look forward to much future success at all of our campuses, not just U of O. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rep. Greenlee.
Yes, I'll ask you, and perhaps anybody else has a mic. Do you think the passage of 3118 helped the process rather than hindered it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because even though in the past and currently, I mean, we we seek minority candidates for all positions, but particularly for coaches and head coaches. But what 3118 did is it made sure you couldn't, you know, it was forefront. It just puts that in your mind to say, make sure. It gives you that special emphasis on being sure that you are giving due credit to minority candidates. And it also means that you reach out. I mean, we did this before, but very explicitly now in the football coach search, we contacted the Black Football Coaches Association and asked them for recommendations and names and who was ready to move into this kind of Division I position. Now, I think we might have done that otherwise, but for sure I can say that we did it knowing we wanted highly quality minority candidates in the pool.
Thank you. And just to follow up on that, you know, that reaching out to the Black Football Coaches Association, you know, really meets the spirit of affirmative action, right? That is, you're taking affirmative steps to diversify your applicant pool. A lot of people think of affirmative action as being a kind of quota system, but it's a set of strategies that's being used to make sure that the net is being cast appropriately broadly.
And if I could add, Chair Dembro, I would echo what Dr. Davis says, and to answer Representative Greenlick's question, I think it does put things on the forefront, but then it just kind of, because recruitment strategies and developing pools and outreach become absolute, there's a premium placed on those activities, it impacts all of our recruitment. I mean, when you introduce software solutions and data collection strategies and outreach strategies, it not only impacts how we recruit for head coaches and athletic directors, but with those systems in place, we use those for the searches across our universities, across all positions.
Thank you. And I will say that, you know, at the time of the news items around the football coach hiring, both Rep. Greenlick and I spoke with Athletic Director Rob Mullins, and I think had good conversations with him. We had hoped to have him here as well today, but I hear that University of Oregon is otherwise occupied at some
yes.
tournament.
He's involved with an athletic venture for the University of Oregon currently in San Jose, California.
Thank you. Any other questions, colleagues? Okay. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We have an additional panel. Bob Davies, president of Eastern Oregon University, Sam Sachs, and PSU head football coach Nigel Burton, please. Bob, yeah, you want
if it's
to
okay,
start? Sure, Mr. President.
For the record, my name is Bob Davies. I am have been the president at Eastern Oregon University for the last 4 years, so I proudly serve at your will, and it's my pleasure to be here today to talk about this important initiative. I also would like to thank Representative Greenlick for specifically asking me to join and talk about our efforts at Eastern Oregon University. At EOU, we live in a town in an area that is not very diverse. Our population diversity in Union County is less than 5%. We view this bill, this action, as an important part of not only with athletics, but with the entire university and our effort to make sure that we're serving the region in very, very robust ways. With this bill, and as was asked just momentarily ago, does it help us in our efforts? Absolutely, it helps us in our efforts because it brings a spotlight to it. It brings attention to the issue, not only for our athletic department, but our faculty hires, our staff hires, our classified hires, in a way that we are able to bring a sense of diversity and inclusion and equity across our area through the university. So this bill is extremely important. Our attention to it is also very, very robust. We have enjoyed some great success in the last 4 years with regards to recruiting minority coaches and working with those individuals to bring a sense of commitment to the institution. It's also very important important when we also look at our campus in itself, where 25% of our students on campus are in fact student athletes. And with a campus diversity ratio of around 15%, and for our athletes where it's upwards of 25%, to show to these student athletes that there is leadership opportunities, to physically show that there's leadership opportunities that they can grow into and that they're not being limited. That is the way that we approach this activity. This is the way that we feel about this bill and why I think we've been able to be very successful with it, again, not only within the athletic department, but throughout our university. I am pleased to report just yesterday I received our diversity numbers for our faculty and staff, and we have more than doubled what we've had in the past over the last 3 years. We have a diversity of faculty and staff on our campus that's approaching 9%. Again, our area is only 5%. And so, again, being that living beacon in our area is very, very important. So I thank you very much for your time. I thank you for your leadership. If possible, if you do have any questions, I would like to take them now, because Ways and Means is waiting for me, and that's where the money is, and that's where we go.
We wouldn't want to get between you and Ways and Means, President Davies.
Well, Representative Comp gave me some good ammunition on earlier testimony.
That's right. Yes, Rep. Greenlick, please.
Your tragic situation with your women's volleyball coach, I think, pointed out one of those examples when it just makes sense to say, we're going to do what we're going to do without regard to this. I think we intended to have lots of opportunities to deal with the reality of a situation.
Thank you very much for that. And Chair Denbrough and Representative Greenlick, that was a tragic occurrence with a very, very a young lady with an extremely bright future who was tragically killed in a car accident a mere few weeks before the season started. We were fortunate to go back to the coach who she replaced, who resigned from Eastern because she was with child, and they found a way to, well, she now coaches with child and on the bench, so we found a way to make it happen. So diversity always comes in multiple ways, and it's how do you serve the individuals and make it work best.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Just a comment. I just want to thank you for recognizing that this is a university-wide issue, not just with athletics. I for years, I was always concerned at the University of Portland that I would say 98% of the African-American male population, student population, was on the basketball team. Thank you.
Yeah, I understand. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, President Davies.
Thank you.
I know we'll see you again on another topic.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Yes. Sam, you want to go?
Sure.
Sam, welcome. Just for those of you who don't know, Sam is sort of the father of House Bill 3118, and we're very grateful to you for your activism and your support of this issue.
Father and the mother.
Thank you. Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, I want to thank you for allowing me to speak here today. As you mentioned, I am the activist or the person that brought this bill to the legislature back in 2009. And I didn't expect that I would be back here today speaking to you. But I am, and the reason for it is I have concerns with some of the schools and the way that they are complying with the Rooney Rule. Initially, when I brought this to Representative Greenlick and former Senator Suzanne Bonamici, I never had an intention to punish schools or to put a penalty or sanction in the law, because my hope was that.
Sam, let me interrupt you for a moment. You have to identify yourself and stay back from the mic.
Okay.
These mics are extremely sensitive, so you can just be actually back.
Okay.
Or push the mic forward.
I'm Sam Sachs, so as I was saying, so it was never my intention to punish schools, but to make sure that they went the extra mile, the extra effort to seek out and interview qualified minority candidates for these positions. As you can see in this report, and I don't have the finalized report, Eastern Oregon probably is the model of reporting and statistics on how many applications they had, how many people they interviewed, how many of those were qualified minorities, et cetera. My concern is that when you look at Oregon State University, Portland State University, which is where I graduated from, and the University of Oregon, they don't offer any statistical information, and that's a concern to me because I personally, as a you know, a member of society in the state of Oregon, I would like to know how many applications they got for the University of Oregon football team. It's one of the highest paid positions in the state of Oregon. And they were able to put in an advertisement, get applications, interview people, and hire a coach with, I think, within 72 hours. I don't know about you, but that's concerning to me. And I hate to be a Debbie Downer, but and with all due respect to the University of Oregon, some of the things I didn't share with you that I learned from my conversations with members inside the University of Oregon and inside the search is that they interviewed two minority candidates. One of the minority candidates they interviewed, from the information I gathered, was prior to Chip Kelly ever stepping down, which doesn't fall under the compliance with the affirmative action laws. So coach would actually have to resign before they conduct any interviews. The other coach that they interviewed, Pep Hamilton, I've been told that the school already knew that he was going to the Colts. I believe they interviewed him the same day that he took position with the Colts. It sounds, my statements to you sound accusatory, and that's not what I'm trying to do. What I'm trying to say to you is those issues raise concern for me as a person who brought this law forward. I think that the University of Oregon's hiring process, specifically towards the football coach, needs to be reviewed. So I'm here today to ask you and to say to you as legislators, I would like to see that reviewed. Furthermore, I want to make my comments brief. I think that a lot of schools, you know, Western Oregon, Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon, are doing their best to comply with this law. And I think it's a good law. But I think we can do better. And I think there needs to be some accountability. Oregon State admits that they have practices in place that far exceed the state and federal laws for affirmative action, yet at the same time say, we're sorry, we forgot the Rooney Rule when we hired our softball coach. That's a concern to me. So, very quickly, I'd like to just recommend four things that I think that could make this law better. One is to implement some kind of a sanction or a penalty. So if the school violates the Rooney Rule or the affirmative action process, they are held accountable. Unfortunately, that's not something I wanted to do, but I think it's necessary in the wake of Oregon State's admission and the University of Oregon, to me, hiring process, which I think is veiled in secrecy. The second is the speedy waiver affirmative action process that each school has, in which they can go to the affirmative action office and say, we'd like to speed up the process, can we get a waiver? I think that needs to be reviewed and looked at and possibly revamped. Right now it's the norm to get a speedy waiver and not the exception. And I think it should be the exception. In fact, the University of Oregon, to their admission, has a standing agreement. From what they've told me, they don't have to ask for a speedy waiver. They have a standing agreement that if they need one, they can use it. I think that's concerning, and I think that it needs to be addressed and looked at. So I'm asking you to take that under your advisement. The last two are that I think the assistant head coaches, in some way, if possible, should be amended or added to this bill. When I spoke to Mike Riley and Oregon State football coach Mike Riley and Western Oregon head football coach Arn Ferguson, they both said that assistant coaches are the pipeline for head coaches. And Mike Riley suggested that we put the assistant coaches in the bill as well to ensure that, you know, those jobs, which are just as important, get consideration. So that is the third thing. And just lastly, I think that there, I guess the fourth thing is I think there needs to be a review of how schools have done, a more in-depth review than what Mr. Hagman has provided, a statistical, compiling of how many people applied for these positions, how many, you know, how did this school go about reaching out to minority communities. The University of Oregon is a great example. They did it in 72 hours. So they may have followed the letter of the law, but I don't think they in my opinion, follow the spirit of the law. So I bring these to you, and I ask you, I'm just an activist. I have no power, and I have no authority. I have a loud mouth, and that's about it. And I'm asking you, if you find these things concerning to yourself, perhaps take them under advisement and look into them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Sachs. Why don't we hear from Mr. Burton, and then we'll come back and maybe talk a little bit about the U of O situation and your other recommendations. Mr. Burton.
Thank you, Chair Dumbrow, committee members. My name is Nigel Burton. I'm the head football coach at Portland State University. I'm here strictly to speak on my own behalf. I don't speak for Portland State University. I don't speak for Portland State Athletics or Portland State Football, though my assistants may disagree with that last one. I am speaking in support of, as I knew it, as well as House Bill 3118, which has been labeled the Rooney Rule. I support the bill mainly because I always support opportunity, diversity, and inclusion. I was actually hired December 9, 2009, before House Bill 3118 or the Rooney Rule was actually enacted and was actually state law. But I do believe that Portland State University and Athletic Director Tori Chisholm and our President, President Vivel, that they did act in the spirit of the Rooney Rule, even though it wasn't necessarily state law at the time. From what I've been told throughout the process and knowing the business, that we had somewhere between 5 and 7 final candidates for the head coaching position back in 2009. I was one of two minority candidates that was interviewed. I think the thing that sometimes gets people nervous is when they start to think of whether the term affirmative action or the Rooney Rule, all these things that start to speak to quotas or some special agenda that's out there. I promise you, I know for a fact I wasn't hired to fill any quota or agenda. I do believe that I was included in the interview process because I was qualified for the position. I had been an assistant football coach at Portland State back in 2001, 2002. I had coached 5 years at Oregon State for Mike Riley, coaching the secondary. I had also been a defensive coordinator at the Division I level at the University of Nevada. So a lot of what Coach Riley was speaking of and the fact that eventually becomes your pool for head coaches held true for me. My next step was to either become a coordinator at the quote-unquote BCS level or to become a head coach at the FCS level or lower 1A levels. That was really my career path. And because of my love for the city of Portland and the state of Oregon, though I'm a native Californian, which we don't say that much often either.
When you're recruiting.
I especially don't do it. And then I'm probably the first head coach that's ever been booed when my alma mater always gets brought up. I am a University of Washington Husky as well. I know. I think... I was qualified for the position, and there was this spirit of valuing inclusion and diversity from the administration. And from there, that just got me in the process. And that's what I appreciate. It just gave an opportunity. From there, I had to detail what my plan was and how we were going to follow through on that plan and all those things. And, I think throughout that plan and through the process, I was hired. Since I was hired in 2009, we've had our first winning season in 6 years. We've broken our academic progress rate. The record for football, we've broken that record 3 years in a row. We've had the opportunity to, we've recruited the number one recruiting class in the country for our level since then. And we've drastically improved our facilities and a lot of our programs within the football department, really with not a whole lot of aid from the state. It's really been through private fundraising and things. And so I'm very proud of what we've been able to accomplish in a very short amount of time. And I think had Portland State and had our athletic department not valued inclusion or had locked in on one candidate and said, okay, this is what we're going to do, I don't think I would be sitting here in front of you saying that I'm the head football coach. I think that spirit and that opportunity is why I sit before you today. So that being said and done, I thank you for your time, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Burton, and we really appreciate your coming down. Actually, I have a quick question of you. Just following up on Mr. Sachs's point about perhaps extending the Rooney Rule to the assistant coach level, do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I would say, you know, on our staff, you know, we're a very diverse staff. I've unfortunately had to hire way too much over my short term there at PSU. You know, I think, I can only speak for myself, we do that. We go through as many candidates as we have. There's always that thing that speaks to one and another, somebody you're familiar with, that someone on your staff has worked with that can speak to habits and things. But, you know, when you've got 12 to 15 guys in the room, it's pretty rare that someone couldn't say, I know somebody who is also a minority, or that you receive some form of a resume and references that can speak to that. So I would be in support of that.
Mm-hmm. Rep Greenlee.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Mr. Greenlee, thank you for being here. I'm very proud of your successes. When we talked to the question was raised with us as we were working on the bill that, wouldn't these just be pro forma interviews? And when we talked to the Black Football Coach Association, their answer was, we just want to get in the game. Maybe it's pro forma, but we're competitors. If we get into the game, we get into enough games, we're going to win some. Is that your sense? I mean, what about the fact that?
To be blunt, I don't care. I think in the end, you know, obviously, you would hope that you have a legitimate chance to be get the position, but more importantly, I think sometimes you just through that opportunity you can surprise the people who you're interviewing in front of. I would venture to say I know several of the people who were up for the head coaching position back in 2009, and I think it's safe to say I was the youngest. And there were several other candidates who had previous relationships with PSU. I think just having that sense of inclusion and wanting to just open it up a little bit, once I was able to detail the plan, I think maybe I surprised some people in the room and came across as much more detailed, much more, and had a different vision. And I think then I was able to move through the process. I think that's much more important. Is to, just like the BCA said, was to just get the opportunity, get in the game. And, you know, and sometimes I also believe that maybe there are candidates who are right for the job, just not right at that moment. And eventually that job will open again. You know, as coaches, we joke that there's three ways we leave. We either move on to another position, we're told to move on, or we die. So it's going to open again. And
only three ways, and two of them are bad.
Well, you know, it's all perspective. But at some point, that position is going to open again. And sometimes, just having gone through the process, you can then open up, you know, the opportunity to come back, and or someone on that administration moves on to another school and remembers you, mm-hmm. and brings you in for an opportunity somewhere else.
Great. Rep Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's so many.
We don't want to hear anything about that football game at Warner Pacific.
Undefeated since 1937, right there.
Sorry. No problem.
So many similarities with legislators from what you just said. And I, because I relate to Mr. Sachs, loudmouth without any authority, this is really just a comment. Coach, I know you're not here in your official position as a coach, but somebody's cell phone went off behind you, and I don't know who it was, but they left this room in such a blur that you may have a recruit if you put a stopwatch. It was unbelievable speed, and that's the sum of my contribution, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Gilliam. We appreciate that.
A really helpful contribution.
Any other questions? Ms. Davis, could you come up and just to kind of say a little bit more about that situation that happened back in January, because as I understand it, the 72-hour period was, I mean, this was kind of unique and complicated, and we had a coach that we thought was leaving and then changed his mind and then didn't sure. change his mind. Or,
yes. Sure, I can address that. I can first of all address the fact that having served both on the academic side as Vice President for Academic Affairs and as Interim Athletic Director, that search procedures in those two venues are a little different in terms of urgency. And in the athletic department side of things, you're always thinking about which coach might be leaving. And you don't always know until some other athletic director calls you and says, or some head of some pro team calls you and says, we are talking to so-and-so. And it's all confidential and you can't say anything. You've got to start thinking about that process and the likelihood that you've got a head coach leaving. And one of the big reasons is for the stability of the program, for the students' benefit, as well as for the fact that when that potential is out there that a coach is leaving, the other institutions are on your recruits immediately for the instability of the program. And in fact, even in this case, we had a recruit who had committed to the University of Oregon, but in the interim, from the middle of December, when it was first known that Chip was probably had the possibility of going to a couple of different pro teams, that's what they introduced into the process. So you're always thinking about what the potential process could and should be. We did contact affirmative action at that point. I mean, we have always contacted affirmative action, even if perhaps people say we don't have to because we have a blanket. We always have, at least from my knowledge and in my level of participation. So when we were pretty certain at that point in end of December that Chip was very likely to leave, didn't know, he didn't say, obviously because of the team and the recruitment, the discussions started about, okay, what is the process going to be and who are logical candidates? And at that point, there was discussions about who would logically be interviewed, and one of the interviews did take place in early January at the time when Chip said he thought he was probably going to leave. Well, then he stayed, and then he left. And so it was after that point that, again, a minority candidate was interviewed, along with two others, after that point. So there were people interviewed prior to the head coach that was hired and after the head coach that was eventually hired. And because of the recruiting things, that turnaround time was fast from the official date to when it was done. But certainly a lot of thought and a lot of discussion took place prior to that, as it does in any head coaching situation, because you've got to be moving from the recruit perspective, as well as your current team, who then may jump ship and take other, you know, other go to other schools.
Thank you. Sam, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think one of the problems or the concerns, when it's specifically when it comes to the head football coach, is that everybody's in a rush. Everybody's in a hurry to hire the coach now, and they always cite, you know, we don't want to lose recruits. That's really important. We got to make sure we have the stability of our program. I guess as a former football player, college football player at Western Oregon, not really good, but I did play. You know, and as an adult, I have more concern about the stability of those students, and that the schools take a little more time than 72 hours to find that person that's going to be the mentor for the next 4 to 6 to 8 years, and that not only is going to win games, but is going to raise these young men into be, you know, graduates or football players or business people, whatever. Oregon did lose some recruits when Chip Kelly left. Every football program is going to lose recruits when coaches change. So I don't know if I agree with the the running theme that we have to get somebody in quickly because we have to get a new coach. We have to save our recruits. The other thing is that affirmative action laws are set up for a reason. And I think over the last 20 years, not just Oregon State, I think we've all become a little lax in really following affirmative action laws and taking them seriously. We've gotten away from saying, okay, we need to hire a coach. That's important. It's also important that we take our time and follow the affirmative action process and we consider minority candidates. So I understand, you know, the theme, but I don't necessarily agree with it. I think University of Oregon could have taken at least a week. I mean, it's not that much to ask to take more time to interview more applicants. We don't know. It was the biggest job in the country. I mean, I'm sure they probably received at least 20 qualified applications, not just minorities, but non-minorities, and how many of them were approached and interviewed. And as Coach Britton said, you know, Coach Helfrich is probably going to be gone in 5 years. He's either going to be the next Chip Kelly and win and leave, or he won't. And where will we be 5 years from now, whether it's Oregon State or Oregon? What will we value? Saving recruits or making sure that we get the right coach and we honor diversity?
Thank you. Okay, thank you all three of you for coming.
Thank you.
I was just going to add on the assistant coach piece of things.
Yes.
It might be of interest to this group that the new defensive coach that was hired after our head coach was hired is an African-American person, so we have an additional minority on the assistant coaching staff in the football program at the University of Oregon.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much,
thank you.
All three of you. And with that, I'm going to close this informational hearing.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank you for having this hearing. I do appreciate your paying attention to this issue.
My pleasure. Thank you for requesting it, Greenland. Okay, colleagues, I want to note to you that we have again finished early today, and it wasn't because I was here on time, but
because we got so much done before you got here.
Yes. And hopefully we'll do the same on Friday. Okay, we're adjourned.